Okay, welcome to Stage No. 4 years ago, the project Mailpile became alive, and now we have Bjarni with us, telling us more about it. Give an applause to Bjarni.
Oh, hello. Is the volume on this okay? I feel like I'm a bit loud. Thanks for coming. I'm not sure how many of you have played with Mailpile or know what it is, but I'm guessing probably a few. So just to put us in the right place, Mailpile is an email application. It's an email client, something that you would use as a replacement maybe for Thunderbird or Outlook or something along those lines. It was launched here 4 years ago as a project to sort of take email back. And the message that we gave was, you know, we're worried about privacy, we're worried about decentralization, and we're worried about sort of the state of free software email development. And so Mailpile was trying to address all of those things. I'll get into that in more detail. The application itself is built around a search engine for email, and it's intended to be an easy way to get started using PGP encryption. And it has a web interface, and this confuses people. So people think that because it has a web interface, it must be a server, but actually it's more of a client application, something you run on your own computer. It's free software, you can download it and run it yourself, hack on the code, written in Python and using web technology. So in this talk, because it's 4 years since we launched, I wanted to talk a little bit about why we started, what's happened in the meantime, and where we are now. It's been a long time coming, but I am going to say that we're reaching a 1.0. I'll talk about what that means too. And I'm also looking for help. So if you know people that would like to hack on Mailpile with me a bit, we have a small amount of money. There's sort of a little bit of good news and a little bit of bad news giving a talk like this. I mean, the good news is, hooray, the project is 4 years old and it's not dead. I guess that's an accomplishment of sorts. The bad news, and this almost kept me from coming to the conference at all, and has kept me from giving talks, is that we haven't made a release that people can use. We've been in development. We made some beta releases, and people couldn't get them to work, and we went back to the drawing board, and it's just been a really long time. So I managed to get some things that I think that people can actually use. I'm able to announce a release now, so that's the good news. So it's not all bad, but I would like to apologize to people that backed us in our crowdfunding campaign 4 years ago, because we said we'd ship in a year, and it's now been four. So my apologies. One of the things I said 4 years ago is that if search is fast, everything else is easy. This was one of the little talks about the technicalities behind how the project is designed. I was looking through the slides, and I felt that this really represents how we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. Email is hard, and it's a lot of work. And at the time, we raised a bit of money, and we felt like we had loads of cash and loads of time, and we had nowhere near enough, neither time nor money. So the project does go back a bit further. I'm calling this the four-year birthday, but work actually started in 2011. That was just an experiment. I wanted to try writing a search engine for email to sort of get a feel for how you would do that. And I presented that at FSCons in 2011, just as a lightning talk. Just look, haha, I made this funny thing. And then I got on with my life. My friend Smauri McCarthy, he kept badgering me to do something more with it. He's sitting over there. This is, to no small degree, his fault. And in 2013, the time felt right. We had met a guy named Brennan, so there were three of us that were interested in the project, and my life was calm. I had a little bit of spare time. Things seemed easy. I was looking for a new challenge, and we all were. So we prepared this crowdfunding campaign starting in the spring. 2013. And how many people remember what happened in the spring of 2013? So there's this guy named Edward Snowden. and he released some stuff. And all of a sudden, everybody was really, really excited about privacy and security, and in email in particular, but in general, but it spilled over to email. So when we launched our crowdfunding campaign, there was huge interest in this problem space, and it was a problem space that nobody had cared about a year before. So we raised a bunch of money. We raised $170,000. We were only asking for $100,000, so that was a good overshoot. And it was 3,000 different individuals and organizations and companies threw money our way, and it was a really wonderful response. And you know, that's the good news. The bad news is that means that I feel guilty towards 3,000 people. But you know, such is life. So we started working. And the context of the work and the context of the campaign was, in 2013, cool kids didn't write email software. You know, email was not a cool thing to hack on. There were a few people that did, but they were legacy, you know? Email was solved. But at the same time, I think it was, whether it was 2012, but some memo in Mozilla leaked. And in the memo, it said that they kind of wanted to get rid of Thunderbird. So everyone was suddenly worried, oh my God, Thunderbird is going to die. And Thunderbird was and still is the flagship free software email client. If Thunderbird goes away, then there is no free software email client for Windows or the Mac. You know, there's not a lot of options out there. So we were worried about this because we care about free software. We were also concerned that everybody's email was moving into the cloud. People weren't running their mail servers anymore. People weren't storing their data themselves anymore. Everything was going to these big companies. And at the same time as the big companies get all the data, nobody is encrypting it. So companies like Google, and Google's a great company. I have nothing against them. I worked there for a while. But I still don't feel like they should have a copy of everybody's email. But that is pretty close to being the case today, or was in 2013, that something like 90% of all email that was written went through Google servers, and it went through them unencrypted. There's a few other players. You know, there's Microsoft. They run a large email service. Yahoo, a bunch of people still use that. But it's a very, very centralized ecosystem. If you count like the top 10, it's a rounding error, the email that does not go through. And that doesn't mean that both endpoints are using those services, but one of them is. You're communicating with someone who uses Gmail, even if you have your own mail server at home. So that's a concern. All of our eggs are in one basket, if you will. PGP or any form of end-to-end encryption would address this problem, but nobody was using it because it's hard and scary. And look at all of these things, and you think about how you change them. The only business model people had for email is ads and spying. And if your business model is to spy on the content and read it and understand what people are saying, you don't want it encrypted. So there's a conflict of interest there that the big cloud providers are not going to solve email encryption for us. They're not going to protect our privacy from themselves. They may protect our privacy from everyone else, but they still have access to all the data. And so Snowden pointed out why this is maybe a problem, because law enforcement or spies or whoever, they go for these honeypots. These are really attractive caches of information. So that's a problem. Later that summer, so I think a week after we launched our crowdfunding campaign, the Lavabit provider went and shuttered its stores. Lavabit was a small business in the US that provided secure email. And their promise was that all of the data was stored encrypted on the servers, and they did various things. But there was the Achilles heel that everything went through their servers. So when law enforcement came knocking and said, we want the keys so we can decrypt all your stuff, they had no choice but to shut the business. And this demonstrated the problem of secure email sort of in the cloud on someone else's computer. And it also happened in the middle of our crowdfunding campaign, so people got even more excited about MailPile. It was convenient for us. Fast forward 4 years later, what has changed? I would say point one is no longer true. Cool kids do write email software now. There's a lot more going on in email, and especially in email security. People have realized that there's something wrong, and people are working on it. It's not just MailPile, and there's lots of different things being tried. Thunderbird is no longer about to die. Thunderbird is doing fine. They've worked things out at Mozilla, and they have, you know, they have more developers than I do, and you know, they're an active project. It's great. I'm going to talk about the rest a little bit later, but so on the topic of how much has happened, in the last 4 years, we've seen a whole bunch of businesses start up, and all of these business efforts, all of them were focused one way or another on email privacy. Lavabit died, and then it came back to life again. They recently reopened, but they're still doing the same thing. They're still storing people's email in the cloud. I think maybe they're doing a better job, but it's still an iffy thing from my point of view. ProtonMail is a service provider in Switzerland, and their sales pitch is, trust us, we're Swiss. And that's fine. You know, that can be a valid solution for some people. Whiteout, that was a startup that started around the same time as MailPile, and they were going to open source a bunch of things, but provide an online service. They ran out of money, unfortunately. They were really nice guys. Lavaboom, similar story. Tutanotas still exists. Again, it's the same kind of thing. It's an online service where they try to sell to businesses or individuals. But one of the interesting things about all these efforts that I've listed here is all of them had an open source component. Not all of them opened up all of their code, but all of them opened up something. So there was, and there has been this sort of understanding that you're not credible doing security or encryption for email unless people can see your code. So even though these businesses have died, not all of their work is lost. If you're interested in starting up an email project, you can find Whiteout's solution and start building on top of it, which is great. And this was definitely not the case in 2013. There was a lot less going on. In the last 4 years, people have also been working on protocols. How many people here have heard about Dime, the dark internet email environment? This came out of the Lavabit thing, so it's the same guy. So the guy had been running email servers for years and years and years, and he wanted to fix the protocols to make them properly secure. And I actually think it's a really great spec, but it's also really, really complicated. But it's out there, and maybe people will start implementing it, I hope so. Memoryhole is a much smaller effort, but also much more pragmatic. This was an effort to just encrypt the headers of the message. So I don't know how many people here have sent PGP email, but usually when you send PGP email, the subject line is not encrypted. And neither is the from address or the to address. You know, so there's all of this stuff that is actually potentially sensitive that is sent in the clear. So it's only the message body itself that gets encrypted. And memory hole was and is an attempt to just make minor tweaks to the way we do PGP email today to protect more of the header information. And it's implemented in MailPile. It's implemented, I think, in a few other mail clients now. I think Enigmail supports it. That's great. It's progress. It's a tiny thing, but this was broken for like 20 years. So good news. WKD, sorry, I should have written that out. That's Web Key Discovery. So this is a protocol from the GNUPG developers. And what they're trying to address is the problem of centralized key servers and how difficult it is to sort of find people's keys. And they want to use the web for that. So this is basically a specification of how you can put your keys on the web and they can still be discovered by people using PGP implementations. So that's great. The final one that I'm talking about here is called AutoCrypt. And this is the one that I'm most excited about. And this is where we are using PGP technology, but we're sort of leaving behind some of the cultural assumptions behind PGP and trying to make things a bit more like WhatsApp, where you install an AutoCrypt-capable email client, and it will just start encrypting. And if it needs to change keys, it will just change keys. It won't have the same security guarantees or the same promises as people have come to expect from proper PGP, but it's still better than clear text. And it's a stepping stone. So once you've got AutoCrypt working, if you want to upgrade to a more secure way of encrypting your mail, it's straightforward because you already have the keys, you have the software, and you know how to use it. So that's something that's ongoing in a bunch of meetings and great fun. I'm not going to talk about all these, but there's a bunch of email projects in the free software space, and I listed these because these are not really associated with any of those startups that I talked about before. Some of them are linked, some of them are not. But people are doing all sorts of stuff. And the one that I'm personally happy about as a Python developer is finally there is a native Python library for working with PGP. That did not exist when I started working on MailPile, and if it had, I probably would have used it. As it is, I'm not, but I'm really glad that it exists. And the GNU-PG project has been very active. They've been innovating and improving a lot of things. They have added a new trust model. So instead of using the Web of Trust to find keys and evaluate how trustworthy they are, they've added something called TOFU, which is Trust on First Use, sometimes called Trust on First Contact. And they're actually, I think, making that the default in GNU-PG 2.1. So it'll use TOFU, and then it will fall back to the Web of Trust. And this is actually a major change and is a usability win, because the Web of Trust is just a bit confusing. They're also starting to support Tor, so you can do key discovery and key lookups over Tor, so you're not revealing how you your key lookups. If someone's listening to the network, it's very interesting to see which keys you're looking up. That says a lot about who you're talking to. So they've added support to do that over Tor. They've got support for ECC keys, which are much smaller. You know, there's development is happening, and it's great. So the free software ecosystem is a lot healthier than it was. But everybody's email is still in the cloud, and people aren't using these encryption tools yet. Email encryption is still the exception. It is nowhere close to being the norm. It's such an exception that it's practically a rounding error. And the only business model is still spying on your users. If you want to make money doing software development or providing services online, ads is the way to do it. And sort of as a community, I feel that we are failing because we need to have other ways to make money, otherwise people won't have any privacy. And then there's a new bullet point, which is that Snowden is now just another bullet point. And I mean no disrespect to Snowden and what he did, but everyone is used to it now. We just assume that everything is spied upon, and we've sort of, I don't know, it feels to me like people have kind of given up. The energy that people had 4 years ago for fixing this and doing something about it, it's not really there. But we're still hacking anyway. And I love the topic of this conference. You know, still hacking anyway is very much what we're doing and what we need to be doing. So back to MailPile. This is the full timeline so far. We launched in 2013. We worked and worked and worked. We ran out of money. We worked a bit more. We launched some beta releases. People hated them. They didn't work. And we just kept on hacking. There was some attrition. I've been the only person really able to spend much time on MailPile for about 3 years. So, and it's been mostly self-funded. I haven't been taking money out of the donations that people gave us. I've been saving that for a rainy day, which is today. Well, actually, it's not rainy, but I'm looking to spend that money now. And we have a release candidate now. So you can actually now go and visit our website, install it, add a Debian repository, apt-get install MailPile, and it will probably work. And it's a nice email client. It doesn't do everything you want because email is actually really complicated, but I've been using it full-time for 3 years. A bunch of other people are using it, and they don't want to switch to anything else. It is a suitable email client for some people. So let's talk about what MailPile is, or let's look at it, see how it looks. So again, back to the same slide as before. It's an email client. The user interface is a web page. It has a search engine, and it's built around the search engine. So the metaphor is not messages and mailboxes. The metaphor is searching and tagging. So it's like Gmail in that respect, and different from Thunderbird or something like, I don't know, Desktop Outlook. It's free software written in Python, And our aim is that this is software for normal people. This is not supposed to be software just for techies. And that's what we mean by 1.0. We don't mean this software is perfect, because it's not, but we mean this software is useful and you don't need to be a skilled engineer to make use of it. So I hope that we've reached that point now, and looking for feedback on how close we are to the truth. A couple of things that MailPile is not, because people get confused. It is not a building block for building software as a service. So if you work for an ISP and you want to put a really nice interface on the email you're providing to 10,000 people and tell them that now they have secure email, MailPile is not designed to solve that problem. MailPile is designed to be personal software that you run on your own hardware. And I'm sure someone's going to figure out how to shoehorn it in and provide a MailPile service at some point, but that was not our goal. And we have made some design decisions that will actually make that kind of difficult. It is also not a synchronizing IMAP client. And again, this goes back to, well, two things. But on one hand, the fundamental goal of the project is to get people out of the cloud, to get people to own their data and take control over it. And if you leave all of your email on the server, you're not doing that. So we do want to encourage people to download their mail and store it on their own hardware. I realize that's problematic for a lot of people. Not everyone's going to do it. But we don't, synchronization was not a priority when we started. And it is something we'll probably add at some point, but we're not there yet. It's also not a profitable business. I'm not making a lot of money. It's not a mail server, so it doesn't replace SendMail or PostFix or something like that. It's a mail client. And it's not a calendar, and it's not Facebook, and it's not all sorts of things. It's just an email client. So, demo time. I'm just going to show you guys. So, start with the website. Actually, I'm going to pull up my notes so I don't skip anything. So, our website, www.mailpile.is. You can now click on download and click on download packages. This link was not there this morning. And we have both the Debian repository, and we have individual packages if people want to download those. So these are, we're providing two packages. One is just MailPile itself. And if you install that, then you're using it on your computer. It's sort of a desktop installation. And then you can install MailPile Apache 2, which will do a little bit of integration magic with Apache on that machine. So you can provide MailPile to a small number of users. So you create users Bob, Joe, and Jill as Unix users on that machine. They will be able to log on through the web, launch their MailPile, and access it. So for like home setup using a Raspberry Pi or something like this, this might come in handy. And these are NoArc packages. You can install them on any distribution, well, any Debian-based distribution. So that includes Ubuntu. Kubuntu, we've got Debian 8 and 9, and Ubuntu LTS are all tested, and they appear to work. Need feedback. This is new. And we have two different sort of repositories that you can follow. You can either follow the nightly repository, which will give you a package of whatever was in master, the master branch on GitHub last night, or you can follow the release branch, where we'll make more of an attempt to keep things stable and only push bug fixes. So. What does that look like? So if I have installed MailPile, I can run it, and it will say that. And I'm hoping most of you can see this. But MailPile at the moment is still, in part, a command line application. You run it in the terminal, and then you can give commands. You know, hello. That's not a command. But it has a web interface. And when you first run it, the interface looks like this. So this should be that instance. Yeah. I can choose a language, and I'm just going to go for English. We have a translation community. The translators are a bit behind because I haven't been updating, but that's one of the things that we will, when the translators have caught up, we'll call it a 1.0 and not a release candidate. So if this were an SSL connection, my browser wouldn't complain. So the first step is you choose a passphrase or a password. And Because MailPile will store your data encrypted on your local drive, this passphrase that you choose unlocks everything. It's also the passphrase that is used to protect whatever credentials you give MailPile for downloading your mail from other servers. So I encourage people to use a good one, but more importantly than using a good passphrase, use one that you can remember because there is no recovery. So I've given it a crappy short password instead of the one that it suggested. So now we're in the app, and this is one of the things that has changed since our beta releases. Our setup flow used to be 10 steps long and asked very confusing questions. And that was one of the reasons people couldn't get the software to work. So now we don't do that anymore. There were no questions except just your password and your language. We ask people to review their privacy settings. They can also just ignore them and click save. You can use Tor to protect your privacy when MailPile goes out to download something. You can decide whether or not to send a ping back to the project to get information about new releases. If you don't want to do that, you don't have to. MailPile will download things from the web. It will download avatars from Gravatar, and it will try and find PGP keys, and it'll do things like that, and you can tell it not to. And you can control how your data is stored. Obviously, I think the defaults are great, so I'm not changing anything. And now I can add an account. And this is what that looks like. So by default, it would go and it would detect settings. And then it tries to auto-discover your mail server and, you know, do all of the things that you would expect a mature app to do. Because I'm doing a demo, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to show you the steps if you do it by hand. Here I can choose various protocols. But for simplicity, so this is what SMTP looks like. And you can choose password or OAuth authentication. It's very basic. It should be familiar to anyone that's set up a mail client. I'm telling it that I'm just going to use local files at the moment because MailPile is actually very good at that. If you have a pile of email that goes back 20 years, it's in mbox files or mailders or something, you can point MailPile at all that stuff. It'll read it, index it, and it'll let you search it and work with it. And that's something that I care about. So telling it to use local files. You could also use IMAP or POP3. But I'll let you guys play with that yourselves. Finally, by default, MailPile will offer to create a new PGP key for you. And I'm hoping that most people will just go, what's that? Just click add, go, next. And suddenly everyone has a PGP key. That's one of the things we're trying to accomplish here. So here we are. We've created an account. And I was going to add some email. So I was working with local files, so I have to use this browser thingy. I go home. Oh, look, there's a file with some mail in it. I can tell it that I would like this email to be treated as new mail, so it goes to an inbox. This is something you might do on a legacy setup where you have proc mail delivering to a file somewhere and you want to treat that as your inbox. You can do that here. If you want, you can tell it to copy the mail. Or you can leave it where it is. It doesn't matter. So now things should be happening. If I go back here. Hello, hello, 1, 2, 3. Hello, hello. Ah, I'm back. So, sorry that didn't happen on a more interesting page, but as we can now see, the PGP key for MailPile, my email address, is ready for use. Hooray! And now we have a little lock here, which we didn't have before. I was adding mail, and you can see I'm standing in the way. You can see in the sidebar there's now a representation of local mail and the file, the mailbox that it pulled it from. And I can click on that. This is what that looks like. The mail is also in the inbox. But so there's a difference here. If you look at it in the original mailbox, it will show you that it's been tagged with that, which is the inbox tag. Whereas if you're in the inbox, there's no point showing you that because you're in the inbox. You don't need to see the tag there. Create a new tag. And we have a whole bunch of options. We can add it to the top here. So that's the top section up there. If this is super important, we can put it there. We can hide it from the search results if we don't want it to corrupt things. Various options. One of the more exciting ones is down here. You can enable automatic tagging. And what that means is that there will be a Bayesian filter attached to this tag. And anything you drop in is treated as training for yes. And anything you pull out and put somewhere else is training for no. So you can have custom tags that learn categories from statistically. So it's not just spam, basically. We took the spam filter and we just repurposed it. You can use it for anything you like. I use that quite a bit myself to just take notifications from GitHub and spam from Facebook and Twitter and mailing lists and newsletters. Just MailPile just puts that all to one side, which is nice. So I've created the tag. It showed up at the very top there because I asked it to do that. I can decide that that's a bit lame, and I'm going to click on the Organize button in the bottom. I'm sure you couldn't see me do that. There's in the sidebar, there's a button that allows you to organize, and then you can start dragging things around. So there's a lot of drag-drop stuff in the user interface, which at the moment I need to tell you because the app doesn't give people hints about that yet. But both the tagging and a lot of the organizing is done by drag-drop. Oh, that's not what I wanted. Okay, so I've moved Sha down here to the bottom, and I can click on it. There's nothing in it. I can edit the settings again, give it a different icon. It's like this happy vacation. Nice royal purple. And now I can start tagging stuff. So I go back to the inbox, and I can drag Sha to something. And that should have showed up. Maybe we found a bug. Okay. Now confused. All right. It's there. Not sure why it didn't show up. Maybe I configured it that way by accident. I can also drag things the other way. I can take messages, and I can pull them to the sidebar. So I can say, this message is spam. Yuck. Well, now it's gone to spam. So that's MailPile. You drag things back and forth. If you're dragging a message, then you're moving it. If you drag a tag, then you're just adding a tag to the messages you dropped on. There are key bindings. I can move around with the keyboard, select a bunch of stuff. When things are selected, you get little icons up there underneath that big black thing. You can do stuff. You'll have to trust me on that. I'm running a little short on time, so I'm going to check my little list. I was going to show you just what my own mail pile looks like. So once I've used it for a bit, I have a whole bunch of accounts. I have a bunch of custom tags here at the side. These ones are, notifications is one of the ones that is self-training. Promotions as well. eBay. Oh, breast augmentation options. That's not nice. So some spam gets through. And when spam gets through, the correct thing to do is mark it as spam. Goodbye. So that's that. I'm going to show you guys another thing that happened within the last year or so is we now have a mostly working responsive interface. So if I make MailPile in the browser window smaller, the tags move, maybe they change. If I make it even smaller, the layout becomes a bit more sort of mobile phone friendly. Oh, sorry. Okay, so you can see the bottom. So if I make it narrow enough, the tags move to the bottom. You can still drag them and drop them. So it's still the same interface, but we move things around a bit. I haven't shown you a message. This is what it looks like when I'm reading mail. EFF thing. If it's part of a message thread, if there's a conversation going on, then that will be displayed in the side underneath the recipients. I don't think I have any conversations in this, but I can sort of create one. I go down here and say reply. Let me get a composer that looks like that. Send an important message, the EFF. And so this is what the bottom of the composer looks like. I can tell it to attach my key if it hasn't decided to do that automatically. If I have multiple accounts, I can choose which account I'm sending as. And here I have, in the corner, I have some encryption options. I can say I would like to encrypt it, and it says you can't do that because you don't have the keys. I can click to search. It's relatively straightforward. One of the things that MailPile does, which is one of our, well, I think it's an innovation, is that the state of those buttons, the encrypt or sign buttons, will depend, it's not always the same. It depends on who you're communicating with. So if you're exchanging email with someone who always signs their mail with PGP, and you have a key, by default, after a while, MailPile will say, hey, maybe we should encrypt to this guy. So it will ratchet up the security of your communications just over time. And it won't do it uniformly. It will try and be context aware. Like if this person who you're communicating with, PGP signs half their mail, but the other half is not PGP signed, it will not do the same thing. It won't suggest that we should encrypt to that guy because we have information that tells us he might not be able to read the mail. And then it becomes a matter of the user can still choose to encrypt, but we're not going to do it automatically because that would interrupt the flow of conversation. So we're trying to do things like that, and it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out when we have a few more people using it. Finally, this is the multiple user interface, which I wanted to show you as well. So here I've created a user with an account, and I can say test, I think his password is testing, it's a really good password. And it does some things, thinks about it, and if it's working, there we go, we have MailPile. And so this is going through Apache. So you can do this on a machine that is running other things. I realize Apache isn't cool anymore. I would like to do the same thing for Nginx, but there's only so many hours in the day, and maybe someone who knows Nginx can help out. So that's my demo. We've walked through a lot of the app, not quite all of it, but a bunch. You can try it yourself, and I encourage you to try it yourself. We built these Debian packages. The source is still out there if you're not running a Debian-based distro. If you're on Mac or Windows, you're going to have to wait a little longer unless you're that much more of a hacker. And I have MailPile shirts, so I'm going to do a little game over the weekend. If you bring me your laptop and show me that you've installed MailPile, I will give you a shirt. And I really hope I don't have to carry all the shirts back home. And I also have stickers as well. Final point of the talk, help, help, help. I'm looking to hire people to help me with the Mac and Windows desktop versions. We need to do things like think about app lifecycle. What happens when people start the app? How do you quit the app? You know, sending people to a terminal to run it the way I just did for you is not acceptable. We need something more user-friendly. We need to integrate a little bit with the desktop. There needs to be an icon somewhere. There needs to be something familiar for people to interact with. And then we need packages. And these are all things that I could figure out if I had loads of time. But I know there are people that already know how to do this. And I would like to pay them some money to help me. So the source of that money is the Bitcoin that was donated at the beginning of the campaign 4 years ago. At the time, Bitcoin was worth about $100. I was told last night that it's at 3,000 now. So I can actually afford to hire people again. So even if you don't want to work with me, and even if you don't want to use MailPile, please make Bitcoin worth more money. Just pump it up. That's it. Thank you for listening. And I would love to take questions if there's time for that. Do I do this myself?
That's loud. Thank you for doing this awesome piece of software, and thank you for your talk. I've got one question. What's the intended use in case of contemporary multi-device environment? What's the, like, how do you use it with multiple phones and desktops? And
a good question. To keep things simple, our multi-device story is MailPile has everything. You use a mobile browser or whatever. And the tricky bit there is that because this is meant for the average consumer. So the average consumer, they can figure out that they leave this on a computer running at home, but they maybe don't know how to reconfigure their router. So we need to work on solutions to allow people to expose the interface of their MailPile without having to drill holes in their router. And that happens to be my day job. There are also things like Tor, which can do this. So you can have a hidden service, and then that also traverses NAT. But this is one of the things that we want to work on in the future. And the idea is MailPile has everything. All of your devices talk to it. We don't need to worry about complicated synchronization. Next question.
My immediate concern is XSS. So I saw when you were displaying the EFF email, it was the plain text version. Is that intentional, and is that always?
Could you repeat? I didn't get that.
I'm concerned about cross-site scripting attacks and the possibility of someone sending me an email that is then somehow leaked on, with scripts from the same domain that I'm loading all the scripts that actually power the interface.
Yeah, the question is, what do we do about cross-site scripting and HTML mail?
Yes.
Okay. By default, we display plain text. So the user has to request the HTML version. And he can say, I always want to see HTML from this sender, and that becomes a relatively comfortable workflow. That means that if people cold email you some HTML, we're just not going to display it. So that's our first line of defense. Our second line of defense is we use, I forget the name of it. There's a very mature JavaScript library for sanitizing content, DOM Purify. We use that before we display anything, and we also try and lock things down using the modern browser. There are basically some headers and things that you can set that tell the browser that it's not allowed to do certain things. And we make that as strict as we can. There are limits to it, though. So it's a risk. We can mitigate it. We can't eliminate it.
And then how about for sandboxing for the server-side indexing of the content? You search my mail, so that means you have the content of my mail, which means you're parsing my mail. And if you're parsing the HTML, that's complex. If you're like decoding MIME stuff, that's also complex. You're doing Bayesian filtering to try to identify spam, that's complex. There seems to be a fairly large attack surface here. So I'm wondering how you're trying to mitigate someone from getting arbitrary code execution in the same context that has access to all the other mail that somebody else sent me.
That's a huge topic. Our first line of defense is that we write as much as we can in Python. So there are fewer ways to exploit Python code than there are if it's a C library. But we do use C libraries as well. And there may be flaws. And this is just like any other piece of software. So I'm not pitching MailPile as the most secure email client. It's an email client. And all email clients, they have to think about these things. And we need to get updates and out there. And that's why I didn't call it a 1.0 until I had a repository where people could get updates. So it's hard. And we could use help.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
My last thing is a comment. Sandstorm has done a lot of really awesome work in this area and might be worth looking into for the sandboxing portions of this.
Yeah, Sandstorm is very interesting. Thank you. Next.
Imagine like the normal user using this app, because a web app that is also, you can install the app, but it's still a web app. It seems kind of confusing for normal people. So how do you imagine normal people using it?
So I think your question is this not confusing to the user that it's a website that's also an app on their computer? And how do we deal with that? And I don't know. And that's part of
That is part of why I need help with the Windows and the Mac integration, is we need to see what we can do to make that experience at least intelligible. So we need some sort of splash screen that says, welcome to MailPile, this is how it works. It's a little bit different, but maybe you'll like it. We're just going to need to educate people on that.
Would you consider bundling it like with a WebKit thing, or do you really intend it to be a service?
So the question is whether we want to bundle our own WebKit, use something, we could ship an app that bundles WebKit and it all runs inside that. The downside is then we become the owners of all of the security updates for that browser bundle, and I would rather leave that to the operating system and the professionals. That's way too big. It also has the downside that then you have to think about the integration when the user is clicking on links. Maybe they want to have three tabs open. At the moment, I'm leaning towards putting people in their default browser where they are comfortable, and they just need to understand that there's a link between those things. But if someone does a really good job giving me an integrated WebKit, I'm not sure I would say no. But it's a hard task.
So, okay, I think we have time for last one very short question. Thank you.
How does MailPile work together with smart cards? Because what I learned from the Snowden revelations was that it's a good security measure to keep your private key not on your computer, but instead on a special device, like on a smart card. And how does it work together with MailPile?
The short answer is I don't know. I have not tested it. The strategy that we have for that is we're using GNUPG under the hood. So if you're running it on your desktop and GNUPG has access to your environment, it can pop up the same dialogues as usual. But this is not something that I consider to be a primary use case, because what happens when you do this is encryption becomes special. It is not something you do with all of your mail. It's something you only do with the important mail, because interacting with the smart card is annoying. You have to type in a PIN. You have to keep doing extra steps. And if you're going to do that for every single email you send, and then you have to do it again for every single email you read, you're not going to like using that email client. And if we want people to use encryption as a routine thing all the time, it has to be convenient. So people that have excessive, you know, high security needs and want smart cards, I would like to support that use case, but that is not my main goal.
Okay, thank you very much for all your efforts, Björn. Give him a warm welcome applause. Thank you very much.